Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the January 13th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Why is the American Diet So Deadly? By Dhruv Kolar. Annals of Medicine, Why is the American Diet So Deadly? A scientist tried to discredit the theory that ultra-processed foods are killing us. Instead, he overturned his own understanding of obesity. By Dhruv Kolar. Until recently, Guillaume Ranieri, a 42-year-old man with a bald head and a bushy goatee, worked as an HVAC technician in Gonesse, a small town about 10 miles north of Paris. The legend lends its name to Pain de Gonesse, a bread historically made from wheat that was grown locally, milled with a special process, and fermented slowly to develop flavor. The French elite once savored its crisp yet chewy crust and its tender, subtly sweet crumb. Ranieri would occasionally grab a loaf from a boulangerie after work. He doesn't consider himself a foodie, but you know, I'm French, he told me. After Ranieri's wife got a job at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, they moved to the U.S. The transition was something of a shock. The food here is different, he said, in a big, heavy French accent. Bigger portions. Too much salt. Too much sugar. He decided to enroll in a paid study at his wife's new workplace. It was exploring why the American diet, compared with almost any other, causes people to gain weight and develop chronic diseases such as at such staggering rates. I wanted to know what is good for my body, he told me. In November, for 4 weeks, Ranieri moved into a room that featured a narrow hospital bed, an austere blue recliner, and an exercise bike, which he was supposed to use for an hour a day. It's not as bad as it looks, he said. His wife took to visiting him at the end of her shifts. Once a week, he spent a full 24 hours inside a metabolic chamber, a small room that measured how his body used food, air, and water. He was not allowed to go outside unsupervised, owing to the risk that he might sneak a few morsels of unsanctioned food. Each day at 9 a.m., 1 p.m., and 6 p.m., Ranieri was given an enormous meal, about 2,000 calories, and instructed to eat as much as he liked. During the first week, he was offered minimally processed foods, such as salad, vegetables, and grilled chicken, and he felt great. But every Friday, researchers changed his diet. He was soon eating calorie-dense processed foods that, in his words, just sat in my stomach. Chicken nuggets, fries, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. He developed heartburn and began to feel bloated, sluggish, and irritable. A few days before Thanksgiving, I entered the imposing brick building known as the NIH Clinical Center, the world's largest hospital dedicated to scientific research. I crossed into its cavernous atrium, bought a granola bar, organic expeller pressed canola oil, soy lecithin, soluble tapioca fiber at an in-house coffee shop, and took a bite in the elevator. Then I followed Emma Grinstuff, a research assistant, to Ranieri's room. Ranieri was sitting in bed, scrolling through his phone in pale blue pajamas. Biometric activity bands were wrapped around his waist, wrist, and ankle. It was almost time for his daily resting energy expenditure test to gauge how his metabolism was changing from one diet to the next. Ranieri lay down. Grindstaff dimmed the lights and fitted what looked like an astronaut's helmet around his head. By measuring what Ranieri breathed in and out, a machine could approximate how many calories he was burning and how many of those calories came from carbohydrates versus fat. Breaking down fat takes more oxygen than breaking down carbs, and research suggests that people metabolize more fat on a less processed diet. A monitor estimated that he'd burn around 1,700 calories if he lay in bed for the rest of the day. After the test, Ranieri's extra-large breakfast was rolled in on a cart. Because observation can influence a person's eating habits, I was asked to leave. You might skip that extra donut if someone's watching. He got to work on a veggie omelet, tater tots, and a jug of milk that contained added fiber. In the past half century, nutrition scientists have blamed health conditions such as obesity, diabetes, and heart disease on many features of the American diet, including sugary beverages and saturated fat. These factors surely contribute to Americans' uniquely poor health. But Kevin Hall, the NIH study's principal investigator, was researching a possible culprit that wasn't named until the 21st century, ultra-processed food. The problem, Hall believed, might have less to do with high levels of sodium or cholesterol than with industrial techniques and chemical modifications. From this perspective, homemade jam on pain de gonesse would be fine. Smucker's on Wonder Bread would not, even if it contained less sugar and fat. The thesis is that we've been focusing too strongly on the individual nutritional components of food, Hall told me. We're starting to learn that processing really matters. In recent years, dozens of studies have linked ultra-processed fare to health problems such as high blood pressure and heart attacks, and also to some problems that one might not expect: cancer, anxiety, dementia, and early death. One analysis found that women who ate the most ultra-processed food were 50% more likely to become depressed than those who ate the least. Another found that men who consumed more had substantially higher rates of colon cancer. Most of these studies controlled for confounding factors such as income, physical activity, and other medical conditions. A focus on a food's level of processing can lead to odd conclusions, however. Julie Hess, a research nutritionist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has pointed out that ultra-processed food puts canned kidney beans and gummy bears into the same category. Processing also has some benefits. It prevents food from going bad or being contaminated during storage and transport. It allows more people to eat convenient and varied meals, even when particular foods are not in season, and it helps the world feed a growing population. Walter Willett, a Harvard professor who may be the most cited nutrition researcher in the world, argues that studies like Hall's are worse than worthless. They're misleading. He prefers to focus on the combinations of foods that people eat over time and advocates for plant-based whole foods and the Mediterranean diet. While Ranieri was having breakfast, I went down to a metabolic kitchen in the basement, which looked like a chemistry lab in the back of a restaurant. Ranieri's lunch and dinner were already being prepared. Chicken breasts sizzled on a stovetop, and the smell of fried potatoes made my stomach growl. A lot of chefs like to be creative, Meryl Kozlowski, a woman in a blue baseball cap, who serves as the kitchen's director, told me. What we're looking for is people who are meticulous about following instruction. Hall and his colleagues had developed exacting protocols so that less processed meals would closely match ultra-processed meals in terms of nutrients like salt, sugar, protein, and fat. This was meant to isolate the effects of processing. Tomato slices and lettuce leaves sat on a scale, which weighed food to the nearest tenth of a gram. A large stopwatch for keeping track of cooking times ticked nearby. Instructions on a clipboard explained how much specific foods, vegetable broth to add to soups A1 through E1, whose fat contents range from 0.39 grams to 5.61 grams. I asked a tall, brown-haired cook which diet he most likes to prepare. Preparing a day's worth of ultra-processed meals might take an hour, he said. Unprocessed meals could take 3 to 4 times as long. He brought his knife down forcefully, cleaving a carrot in two, and continued, "If I'm swamped, I'd rather make the ultra-processed meal. But if I had to pick one to eat for the rest of my life, unprocessed, no question." A central question of the study is whether, consciously or unconsciously, participants eat more when they're given ultra-processed foods. And if so, why? This is why participants are offered such immense portions and can stop whenever they want. At one point, Kozlowski pulled a tray out of a commercial refrigerator. The meal looked as though it could feed a family of four. A tub of salad, a bowl of dressing, a container of beans, a cup of salsa, some shredded cheese, a wild rice blend, and two pitchers of seltzer. After a meal, researchers weighed each dish to see how much has been eaten. "Is this processed or unprocessed?" I asked. Kozlowski smiled. "Ultra-processed," she said. "Lots of participants can't tell the difference." The term ultra-processed food was introduced by a Brazilian epidemiologist named Carlos Monteiro. In the early 70s, Monteiro was a primary care doctor in the Ribeira Valley, an impoverished part of rural Brazil, and he treated many plantation workers with swollen bellies, stunted growth, and exhaustion. He started to think they needed better food in larger quantities, more than they needed medicine. He relocated to Sao Paulo, hoping to study malnutrition. Then he learned that around 1 million Brazilians were growing obese each year. Strangely, a shrinking number of people were buying ingredients that doctors blame for the obesity epidemic, such as salt, sugar, and oil. The paradox troubled him. In the 90s, many nutrition researchers began to turn their focus away from individual nutrients. Antioxidants are good, saturated fat is bad, and toward broader dietary patterns. Monteiro developed a theory. Households that bought less salt weren't eating less salt. They were no longer cooking. A growing share of their meals arrived in a package. "The issue is not food nor nutrients so much as processing," he wrote in a landmark 2009 paper. Novel behavioral and brain imaging experiments were showing that eating wasn't always under our conscious control. Monteiro reasoned that something very bad happened when industrial food systems started churning out cheap, convenient, and tempting foods. He argued that scientists should classify foods by their most unnatural ingredients and by their means of production. "Almost all our food is processed in some way, but it matters how and how much." According to Monteiro's NOVA food classification system, Group 1 foods are unprocessed or minimally processed: nuts, eggs, vegetables, pasta. Group 2 includes everyday culinary ingredients: sugars, oils, butter, salt. Butter and salt your pasta and you have Group 3 food: processed but not automatically unhealthy. But add a jar of ragu Alfredo sauce with its modified cornstarch, starch, whey protein concentrate, xanthan gum, and disodium phosphate, and you're biting into Group 4 ultra-processed fare. The ingredients of a Group 4 meal tend to be created when foods are refined, bleached, hydrogenated, fractionated, or extruded. In other words, when whole foods are broken into components or otherwise chemically modified. If you can't make it with equipment and ingredients in your home kitchen, it's probably ultra-processed. Monteiro's rubric did not account for industrially farmed crops and livestock, whose use food companies do not necessarily disclose. Monteiro's peers were not immediately convinced. In the 5 years after his 2009 paper, there were essentially no scientific studies linking food processing to ill health. It wasn't clear that his rubric had any more validity than the food pyramid, recommended dietary plates, or the nutrition traffic lights that are used in the UK. But gradually, scientists started to test his theory. In 2015, Hall, the NIH researcher, attended a conference on obesity and presented research into low-fat and low-carbohydrate diets. After he left the podium, some Brazilian nutritionists approached him. "That's a very 20th century way of thinking," he remembers them telling him. "The problem is ultra-processed food." The term sounded nonsensical. Nutrition is about nutrients, he thought. What does processing have to do with it? Hall, who has short salt and pepper hair and often wears a lab coat, originally trained as a physicist. He became fascinated with nutrition after learning to model disease at a Silicon Valley startup. While in a similar role at the NIH, he started working in a metabolic ward that was being built to study diet and exercise. Some of his early research examined metabolic changes in contestants on NBC's The Biggest Loser, who'd lost drastic amounts of weight. After the Brazilian nutritionist told him about their theory, he designed a trial that he thought would discredit it. In a study published in 2019, Hall invited 20 people to spend a month at the NIH Clinical Center, where his team measured how their bodies responded to different types of food. Many researchers rely instead on surveys of what people recall eating. For 2 weeks, participants ate a minimally processed diet, mostly consisting of group one foods such as salmon and brown rice. For the other 2 weeks, they ate an ultra-processed diet. At least 80% of the calories came from group four foods. Hall ended up refuting his own hypothesis. When participants were on the ultra-processed diet, they ate 500 calories more per day and put on an average of 2 pounds. They ate meals faster. Their body secreted more insulin. Their blood contained more glucose. When participants were on the minimally processed diet, they lost about 2 pounds. Researchers observed a rise in levels of an appetite-suppressing hormone and a decline in one that made us feel hungry. It wasn't clear why ultra-processed diets led people to eat more or what exactly these foods did to their bodies. Still, a few factors stood out. The first was energy density, calories per gram of food. Dehydration, which increases shelf life and lowers transport costs, makes many ultra-processed foods, chip, jerky, pork rinds, energy dense. The second, hyperpalatability, was a focus of one of Hall's collaborators, Tara Fazzino. Evolution trained us to like sweet, salty, and rich foods because, on the most basic levels, they help us survive. Hyperpalatable foods, combinations of fat and sugar, or fat and salt, or salt and carbs, cater to these tastes but are rare in nature. A grape is high in sugar but low in fat, and I can stop after eating one. A slice of cheesecake is high in sugar and fat. I must eat it all. In certain areas, these findings defy the logic of earlier theories of nutrition. If the goal was to minimize processing, then a diet that includes butter might be healthier than one that includes margarine, and one that includes cane sugar might be healthier than one that includes zero-calorie sweeteners. The occasional whole egg, which contains more than half the daily recommended dose of cholesterol, might be preferable to packaged liquid eggs, which are protein-rich and sometimes cholesterol and fat-free, but often contain preservatives and emulsifiers. It's common to think about the obesity epidemic, which contributes to nearly 3 million deaths around the world every year, in terms of energy imbalance. Sometime in the middle of the 20th century, the story goes, we started to consume more calories than we burned, and thus we gained weight. There are good reasons to subscribe to this view. Feed virtually any animal extra food and it will gain weight. But research has increasingly complicated the "it's the calories, stupid" model of obesity. Our bodies process carbs differently from fats, for instance. A calorie from corn leads your body to secrete more insulin than a calorie from cheese. Certain food additives seem to activate genes associated with weight gain, and things like weight loss and exercise can reset the body's metabolic rate. The dirty little secret knows what caused the obesity epidemic. Dariush Muzaffarian, a dean at the Tufts School of Nutrition Science and Policy, told me, "It's the biggest change to human biology in modern history, but we still don't have a good handle on why. If anything, Americans began consuming slightly fewer calories after the turn of the 21st century, according to national survey data, yet rates of obesity continue to climb. Obesity rates in the U.S. may now be falling, possibly owing to the introduction of GLP-1 drugs such as Ozempic, but they remain the highest in the industrialized world. Before reuniting with Ranieri, I sat down with Catherine Mackey, a clinician and microbiome researcher who is working with Hall and the Atrium. Mackey leads to what she calls the Poop Squad, which analyzes stool samples to understand how various diets influence the bacteria in our gut. Such studies have been in vogue for the past decade or so, although it has often been difficult to figure out the separate contributions of thousands of kinds of bacteria and to put the studies into clinical practice. The foods we eat leave a bacterial signature inside our bodies, Mackey said. We're getting better at decoding that signature. I bit into the remains of my granola bar. One bacterium, B. theta, ordinarily helps us digest fiber, but if we don't get enough fiber, and 95% of Americans don't, it starts to feed on mucus instead. Think of it as eating the lining of your gut, Mackey said. Not good from an inflammation standpoint. Some of the artificial sweeteners in zero-calorie sodas and no-sugar-added desserts, such as saccharin and sucralose, appear to shift the microbiome in ways that impair the body's handling of sugar. The spread of the Western diet has coincided with striking declines in microbial diversity. Some of our gut bacteria have disappeared altogether. There are also bacteria on our skin, and they too can be affected by what we eat, as well as by things like cosmetics and soaps. The skin microbiome has been linked to increasingly widespread conditions such as acne and eczema. In November, a study reported that ultra-processed foods may cause flares of psoriasis. And so, after breakfast, Ranieri donned a hospital gown in the clinical center's dermatology wing. When was the last time you showered? A dermatologist asked him. Yesterday at 11, Ranieri said. 11 a.m. or p.m.? A.M., he said. The dermatologist seemed satisfied that he was sufficiently dirty. She taped several strips to his forehead and under a tattoo on his back. These would measure the amount of fat that his glands secreted on that week's diet. Then she swabbed several body parts. I didn't need the concept of ultra-processed foods to suspect that last week's oily tater tots had produced the pimple on my forehead, but I wondered what other changes they might have wrought. Scholars of obesity sometimes point out that since the epidemic began, humans haven't had time to evolve as a species. Our food must be to blame. That is true, but incomplete, because the foods we consume change our biology. Highly processed diets might reduce the sensitivity of taste receptors, for example, which could mean that we eat more to get the same hit. Taste presumably evolved to gauge the nutritional content of food, but ultra-processed products don't need to be nutritious to taste good. With a physiological confusion that barely makes it to the surface of our conscious experience, we find ourselves searching for another, searching for that nutrition that never arrived, the physician Chris Van Tolken writes in his recent book, Ultra-Processed People. Some scientists have proposed taste bud rehab to redirect our craving toward healthy options. In the afternoon, I joined Ranieri for a taste test. The aim was to understand how quickly his preferences shifted when his diet changed, whether fries and chicken tenders made his taste buds crave more salt, for instance. Ranieri sat down at a large table, an opaque shield blocked his view of medicine bottles that contained various solutions of salt and sugar. A nurse poured two solutions into paper cups. Ranieri swished the first in his mouth, apparently unperturbed, and spit it into a bright blue bag. But the second made him grimace and stuck his tongue out as though he were sitting through the worst wine tasting ever. Hall's original study, which has been cited nearly 2,000 times, was the first randomized trial demonstrating that ultra-processed foods disrupt your metabolic health and lead people to overeat. It was hugely influential and is widely recognized as the most rigorous examination of the subject so far. It got the most attention of any study I'll probably ever do, Hall said. It also sparked controversy and opposition. By necessity, the study was conducted in a highly artificial environment. Some of its findings might not have persisted. In the second week that participants ate an ultra-processed diet, for example, their excess calorie consumption started to fall. One of the largest studies of ultra-processed food, led by researchers at Harvard, including Ouellette, the critic of Hull's study, divided ultra-processed foods into 10 subgroups. The study was based on survey data from more than 200,000 people, rather than a double-digit number of people in metabolic chambers. Its conclusions were more complicated than Hull's. Two types of ultra-processed foods, sugary sodas and processed meats, increase people's risks of cardiovascular disease, but three types, breads and cold cereals, certain dairy products such as flavored yogurts and savory snacks, seem to decrease their risks. Another five didn't appear to affect it at all. Some food additives are good, some are bad. Most are probably neutral, Ouellette told me. Last month, a committee of 20 nutrition experts released its recommendations for updating the U.S. dietary guidelines. It declined to endorse broad limits on ultra-processed foods, calling the currently available evidence limited, but suggested that people avoid processed meats. Talking to skeptics of Monterio and Hall, I found myself vacillating between excitement about the utility of a burgeoning theory and pessimism about its seeming futility. All of this research is a colossal waste of money, Alan Leibowitz, a professor at James Madison University and the author of Natural, How Faith in Nature's Goodness Leads to Harmful Fads, Unjust Laws, and Flawed Science, told me. We already know why populations are gaining weight, ubiquitous, cheap, delicious, calorie-dense foods. He called it appalling that we've turned this into some kind of research question when the answer is staring us right in the face. He had a point. Many of Monterio's recommendations can arguably be summed up with seven words from In Defense of Food, the 2008 book by Michael Pollan, Eat Food, Not Too Much, Mostly Plants. Even as more studies bolster Monterio's theory of ultra-processed foods, it remains unclear whether any of them will change what we eat. People know that Doritos are not so good for them, but more than a billion bags are sold in the U.S. each year. Who exactly will be moved by the knowledge that salty, sweet, ultra-processed foods might be worse than merely salty or sweet ones? Our food environments, the type and quality of foods that pervade our schools, workplaces, and neighborhoods, influence our diets as much as our tastes do. And our food environments are shaped by our incomes, our government's choices, and our desire for convenience, as well as active manipulation by the food industry through things like marketing campaigns and lobbying for agricultural subsidies. During my medical residency, I often urge patients with diabetes or heart disease to eat healthy foods, only to scrounge my own dinner from onion rings and chicken tenders in the hospital cafeteria. Hull argues that research into ultra-processed food, which makes up an estimated 2/3 of the American diet, could prove useful to the very companies that manufacture them. Industry is just as happy to sell you a healthy version as an unhealthy one, he told me. But Big Food is adept at contorting nutrition science to promote its products. The idea that you're going to get companies to re-engineer their product in this or that way is, I think, totally misguided. Grigory Skrinanis, who coined the term nutritivism to describe reductive nutrient-focused approaches to food, told me. The makers of ultra-processed breakfast cereals can describe their products as part of a balanced breakfast if they add some fiber. Vitamin water is marketed as a health drink, even though a 21-ounce bottle contains almost as much sugar as a can of Coke.
You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, the New Yorker magazine, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Of course, since no previous theory has succeeded in halting or even fully explaining the obesity epidemic, we need new ideas. It's long past since time that the scientific community seriously considered alternative hypotheses, Muff Zarian the Tufstein told me. He thinks that ultra-processed foods have probably contributed to rising obesity rates and suspects that biological changes, such as alterations in our microbiomes, metabolisms, and epigenetics, have played a role too. Historically, there have been separate movements against sugary sodas, fast foods, and harmful additives, but a concept like ultra-processed foods could unify politicians, parents, and public health professionals around a single health campaign. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who may soon lead the U.S. Health Department of Health and Human Services, has made common cause with some lawmakers by railing against ultra-processed food, pledging to remove it from public schools and limit the use of pesticide, artificial dyes, and perhaps more dubiously, seed oils. We need to stop feeding our children poison and start feeding them real, wholesome food again, he posted on X in November. Kennedy's collaborators will need to navigate his thicket of unfounded claims about viruses, vaccines, and wellness fads. Some experts want to eliminate agricultural subsidies for corn and soy. Others have advocated for a tax targeting ultra-processed products, which is being tried in Colombia, or marketing restrictions, which have been introduced in Chile. Shortly after I visited the NIH, Hall flew to London to present preliminary findings from the first 18 participants in his study. He told the audience that his team was testing the effects of four diets, one that was minimally processed and three that were ultra-processed but varied in terms of calorie density and hyperpalatability. Now the drum roll, Howell said. The audience laughed as they pulled up a color-coded slide. When people were fed an ultra-processed diet that was calorie-dense and hyperpalatable, they ate around 1,000 calories more per day than they did on the minimally processed diet. When the team served foods that were calorie-dense but less palatable, participants still ate about 800 calories more. But when the team served ultra-processed foods that were neither calorie-dense nor hyper-palatable, for example, liquid eggs, flavored yogurt and oatmeal, turkey bacon, and burrito bowls with beans, people ate essentially as much as they did on the minimally processed diet. They even lost weight. A murmur rippled through the crowd. Calorie density, probably the feature of food that had the biggest impact on our ancestors' survival, now seems to be among the most responsible for making us overeat. Weight gain is not a necessary component of a highly ultra-processed diet, Hall concluded. He had, in a sense, refuted his hypothesis again. While reporting this story, I became obsessed with checking nutritional labels. But I don't think that I managed a single day without eating an ultra-processed food. I'd order a salad and the dressing would contain preservatives. I'd pick up a parfait and would be filled by a sweetener in the granola. My own medical tests border on pre-diabetes, and I try to cook healthy dinners for my three kids. But I often acquiesce to their demands for pizza, saving myself not only time but negotiations over every broccoli florette. Eat four if you're four, eat two if you're two, and so on. With fries, I have to negotiate with them to stop. In the moment, these concessions feel inescapable and inconsequential. Afterward, while sitting up in bed with reflux, I worry about the example I'm setting and resolve again to do better. On a warm November afternoon at a cozy French cafe in Lower Manhattan, I meet up with a person who, I hoped, might restore a sense of perspective. Marianne Nestle, a towering figure in American nutrition, is a molecular biologist and a nutritionist who started the country's first academic food studies program at NYU, helping to bring attention to the roles that culture, capitalism, and politics play in what and how we eat. She pronounces her last name like the verb, not the world's largest food and beverage company. Now in her late 80s, she bounded up the stairs to the cafe entrance, her curly gray hair bobbing. At the counter, she ordered a black tea with whole milk. I got a drip coffee and, as a provocation, a large chocolate chip cookie. We sat down at a table and I placed the cookie on a napkin. Pretty ultra-processed, right? I said. Butter, sugar, flour, eggs. She said, actually, I think it's probably okay. She broke off a piece and popped it into her mouth. In other ways, she noted, cookies are not exactly healthy. You've got to understand how we got here, Nessel said, launching into a monologue about the evolution of nutrition science. In her telling, the first era began in the early 20th century, after the discovery of vitamins. During the Second World War, the U.S. military leaders were alarmed that many recruits, having grown up during the Great Depression, couldn't join the war effort because of conditions caused by a lack of nutrients, such as rickets, scurvy, anemia, and tooth decay. That came as a shock, and the military became heavily concerned with nutrition, she said. It partnered with the National Academy of Sciences and the National Research Council, which together published the first recommended dietary allowances for various nutrients. Nessel slipped her tea. The second era began in the years after the war, she said, when heart disease was emerging as a leading killer. In the mid-20th century, around the time that scientists were identifying plausible dietary culprits, salt, fat, cholesterol, Nessel's father died of a heart attack. In the late 70s, a Senate committee led by George McGovern issued a report calling on people to consume less dairy and red meat. But after blowback from industry, the guidance was reworked to emphasize nutrients, in this case saturated fats, instead of foods. Eating less is very bad for business, Nessel said. She argues that this act of appeasement casts a long shadow. Even today, when people talk about what we need to eat more of, they talk about food, she said, her voice rising. But when they talk about what we need to eat less of, they switch to nutrients. She pounded the table. A couple seated next to us glanced over. How nutrients find their way into our bodies matters. Sugar in Skittles isn't the same as sugar in strawberries. Fish oil in a capsule isn't fish oil in a fish. The third era of nutrition has considered dietary patterns more holistically. We talk more of the Mediterranean diet and less about the fat and olive oil. Nessel believes that Monterio and Hall have revolutionized the field by narrowing in on what about our diets leads us to overeat. The theory of ultra-processed foods has some frayed edges, she told me, but it offers ordinary people a practical way to make decisions about what to eat. As an organizing principle, it's invaluable. Nessel and I took a sunset stroll past a street vendor selling hot dogs, beef, salt, sorbitol, potassium, lactate, to a nearby grocery store. She jabbed her finger at the nutrition label on a bright green box of Apple Jacks. This is where it starts, she told me. Hydrogenated coconut, modified food starch, germinated yellow corn flour, yellow 6, red 40, blue 1. She shook her head and said, yuck, 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 this is what we're feeding our kids. She lifted up a box of shredded wheat. Now this is the good stuff, she said. There were two ingredients, whole grain wheat and wheat bran. I sprinkle a little sugar over it, she confided with a wink. That way I get to control how much sugar I'm eating, not some corporation. In the dairy section, Nessel compared a whole fat yogurt, milk, bacterial cultures, with a low fat version, milk, bacterial cultures, cornstarch, and pectin, among other things, whose emulsifiers and thickeners improve creaminess and mouthful. See, it can be tricky, she said. It hadn't occurred to me that yogurt with more fat could be healthier than yogurt with less. Still, Nestle told me it matters how ultra the ultra processing is. This yogurt will never be a bag of Doritos. The former was food. It retained the links between taste and nutrients, which our bodies evolved to expect, with some additives. The latter, corn, vegetable oil, maltodextrin, a string of flavorings, and other additives, seemed to be substantially made up of industrial ingredients and only partially made of food. On our way out, we stopped by the bread aisle, and Nestle noted that many whole wheat breads, including a brand that I recently started buying, were ultra-processed. Some use highly processed flours that are cheaper and easier to work with, but are stripped of nutrients such as fiber and minerals. I thought about something that Willette, the Harvard professor, had told me. He and several of his colleagues enjoy the same kind of whole grain bread from Trader Joe's. It's made in a factory, he said. It's ultra-processed, but to say it's unhealthy just because of that is frankly ridiculous. It's perfectly possible to make bread that isn't ultra-processed, Nestle told me, but it doesn't last as long. She read from the label of a healthy-looking loaf. Datum, she declared, referring to diacetyl tartric acid esters of mono and diglycerides of fatty acids, an emulsifier that helps bread maintain its structure. Forget about it. A few weeks later, I drove an hour and a half east from Manhattan to the headquarters of Savarolli Foods, one of the largest pasta manufacturers in the world. Savarolli produces more than 75 million pounds each year and specializes in stuffed pastas such as ravioli and tortellini. Its factory encompasses an entire city block with separate buildings devoted to pastas and sauces. When I arrived, Franco LaRocca, a gregarious man who works as the company's corporate chef and vice president of research and development, told me that his parents migrated from southern Italy to Brooklyn in the early 70s. Growing up, he often awoke to the smell of his grandmother's focaccia, which he'd dip in steaming tomato sauce. He later worked at Union Square's cafe. I still wanted to make dishes that feel like you just ordered them at a fancy restaurant, he told me. I followed LaRocca to a part of the factory that was producing beef ravioli for the day. Before entering, we donned hairnets, safety glasses, and disposable gowns that reminded me of the early days of the COVID pandemic. I washed my hands, stomped my feet in white disinfectant powder, and entered a room that roared like a tarmac. Enormous silver machines glinted under fluorescent lights. Workers milled about with clipboards and what looked like hard hats, as though they were making Toyotas rather than tortellini. A maze of metal pipes crisscrossed overhead, and LaRocca pointed to one of them, which terminated in a car-sized funnel that hung from the ceiling. "That's pumping in flour from the silos outside," he explained over the din. We climbed up to a platform to get a better look. The cone was dumping in rich semolina flour into a gigantic tank. Thick hoses piped in water and eggs. Dough exited onto a blue conveyor belt. A sheeter pressed it into 3-foot-wide carpet. Then a metal mold called a pasta dye determined the shape of the ravioli, square, circle, half moon. Finally, a piston pumped rhythmically up and down, topping the carpet with dollops of ground beef. Savarolli's pasta was processed. It probably had to be, to meet the punishing scale and cost demands of a competitive market. I was trying to decide whether it also earned an ultra. "The price we charge depends on how thin the shell is and how much the filling is inside," LaRocca told me. "The more delicate or unique the shape, and the higher the fill rate, the more it'll cost you." I watched ravioli slide into a horizontal cylinder where it would be cooked. Lastly, it was shaken dry and passed into a freezer that was the size of a studio apartment. In the 40 minutes that the process lasted, the company had made about 60,000 pounds of pasta. You could find features of ultra-processing if you looked. Savarolli's cheese ravioli, for example, is mostly ricotta and enriched semolina flour, but it also contains guar gum, a stabilizer made from heavily processed beans and cornstarch. Still, the company limits processing by cooking and immediately freezing pastas, minimizing the use of additives and avoiding hydrogenated oils. When I described the factory to Nestle, she said, "Industrial alone does not an ultra-processed food make. It has to have the purpose of replacing real food, and usually to be loaded with additives. This doesn't mean that frozen stuffed pasta, with its high levels of saturated fat, cholesterol, and sodium, should be eaten for every meal." Next door workers were making the sauce for macaroni and cheese. 40-pound blocks of Romano cheese sat on a pallet like bricks. Each one had a barcode and would be graded only after a work order had been placed. "Pre-shredded cheese spoils faster," LaRocca said. "This way we can avoid preservatives." A man pushed a boogie full of grated cheese onto a scale. It appeared to clock in at the right weight. "It's not exactly classic Italian," LaRocca admitted, "but people love it." In another room, LaRocca used both hands to lift the lid from a cauldron that stretched 10 feet into the air. Steam misted off a bubbling yellow lava. A buttery aroma filled my nostrils. We add Asiago," LaRocca said. "Gives it a nice aged note." The vat piped its contents into a sort of vending machine for bags of sizzling cheese sauce, which passed through chilled water and into containers the size of dining tables. A forklift ferried some away. I was a little unsettled, but also astonished. Savarolio produced a nearly unfathomable amount of food at modest prices. A pound of spinach ravioli goes for $6, with reasonably high-quality ingredients. It seems to exist on the boundary between ordinarily processed and ultra-processed, and it made me think that there was a middle way, one that, within the practical and economic realities of modern society, could keep people fed without making them sick. Back in LaRocca's kitchen, he fixed me a plate. The macaroni was al dente. The creamy cheese melted in my mouth. I finished it quickly, but refrained from asking for more. "That's good," I told him. He said, "Yeah, but my daughter prefers Kraft." Dhruv Kular, a contributing writer at The New Yorker, is a practicing physician and an associate professor while Cornell Medical College. He writes about medicine, healthcare, and politics. The Current Cinema, Marianne Jean-Baptiste gives a performance for the ages in Hard Truths. In his excoriatingly funny new film, the British realist Mike Leigh reunites with a key actor from his 1996 triumph, Secrets and Lies, by Justin Chang. We first meet Hortense Cumberbatch, the soft-spoken optometrist at the heart of Mike Leigh's wonderful 1996 film, Secrets and Lies, at a funeral. The camera paid her little mind, dwarfed by a crowd of mourners in a cemetery, her head bowed as she murmured along to "How Great Thou Art." Hortense, played with crystalline restraint by Marine Jean-Baptiste, didn't give much indication of being a main character. It's possible that Jean-Baptiste, a black British stage actor and musician with only a handful of small film roles to her name, didn't know it yet herself. One of the curious effects of Leigh's famously unorthodox working methods, in which the shape of a story and the nature of its characters are discovered and perfected through an often months-long process of acting workshops and rehearsals, is that the performers themselves seldom know beforehand whether they're playing a lead or a supporting role. Leigh's approach, dogged in its pursuit of emotional truth, is meant to frustrate such narrative hierarchies to begin with. His dramas, among them the TV movie Meantime, 1983, and cinematic features such as Naked, 1993, Topsy-Turvy, 1999, and Vera Drake, 2004, remind us that no one is a supporting player in their own life, a truth made especially plain in Secrets and Lies, which is predicated on shock revelations and hidden identities. Hortense, having lost both her adoptive parents, set out to track down her biological mother, only to learn that she had been born to a white woman, Cynthia Pearlie, Brenda Blathen. As years' worth of disclosures and recriminations erupted into the open, the serene Jean-Baptiste held us close and rapt. At the climax, amid a flood of family histrionics, our eyes sought out Hortense, sitting on the sidelines, stricken with remorseful silence. Hortense was the first major Black character in a LA film, and as vivid and memorable as she was, you couldn't help wanting more of her and also more for her. Perhaps a scene with other members of her adoptive family, or just one moment in which she was permitted, like Cynthia and her emotionally unfettered kin, to fly into some histrionics of her own. I thought of Hortense often while watching Hard Truths, Lay's blisteringly funny and crushingly sad new movie, in which Jean-Baptiste fumes, rages, and to my mind, gives the performance of the year and likely of her career. Arriving nearly three decades after Secrets and Lies, Hard Truths has the feel of a genuine companion work. Intentionally or not, it expands on, completes, and at times challenges its predecessor. Even its title feels like a blunt rejoinder. Jean-Baptiste plays Pansy Deacon, a middle-aged woman of Caribbean descent who lives in North London with her husband, Kurt Lee, David Weber, and their 22-year-old son, Moses Twain Barrett. Here and there are warm, persistent echoes of Secrets and Lies. The wonderful Michelle Austin, who plays Hortense's friend Dion, returns here as Pansy's younger sister, Chantel. Another cemetery scene looms in the midpoint when Chantel drags a scowlingly reluctant Pansy to honor their mother 5 years after her sudden passing. It should be noted that both movies were shot by Lee's longtime cinematographer, Dick Pope, who died in October. Hard Truths was his final film. The similarities largely end there, where Hortense projected a luminous inner calm, Pansy is profoundly unhappy. From the moment we meet her, she jerks upright in bed, emitting a loud, agonized cry. It's clear that her life has become a chain of rude awakenings and unmitigated miseries. Jean-Baptiste, her mouth set in a tight-lipped frown, her eyes ablaze with fear and loathing, soft pedals nothing. At home, Pansy spends much of her time trying to sleep, complaining of pain and exhaustion. In her waking moments, she scrubs down every surface with presumably a pandemic-bred obsessiveness, giving us ample time to notice her house's blank walls and Spartan chill. She is wary of open windows, which could let in a stray animal from the backyard or even a gulp of fresh air. The very name Pansy feels like a cruel joke. When Moses musters the courage to buy her flowers for Mother's Day, she can't bring herself to touch them. For their part, Moses and Curtly keep their heads down, lest they find themselves on the receiving end of Pansy's fury. Curtly, a plumber, loses himself in his work. Moses, who's unemployed, plays video games in his room and goes on long walks. When Pansy does venture outdoors to see a doctor or do some shopping, she invariably picks fights with strangers, which can rise to impressive peaks of insult comedy flair. Your balls are so backed up, you've got sperm in your brain, she yells at a driver in a parking lot. Back home at the dinner table, Pansy extemporizes ferociously on the micro-absurdities of modern life. The clothing of pets, the noisiness of charity workers, the superfluidities of infant apparel. What's a baby got pockets for? What's it going to keep in its pocket? A knife? Let no one, in their understandable eagerness to praise Lee as an anatomist of the human condition, downplay just how entertaining Hard Truth is. Woe betide anyone who bumps into Pansy on the street, but to watch her on screen produces a kind of bruised exhilaration. Her viciousness has an awesome life force. At a certain point, I began wondering whether Pansy would be best served not by counseling or antidepressants, but by a few pints and an open mic. For some time now, Lay's great subject has been the elusive nature and uneven allocation of happiness, an inequity at the heart of his contemporary working class dramas such as Life is Sweet, 1991, Another Year, 2010, and perhaps most of all, his delightful 2008 comedy, Happy-Go-Lucky. In that movie, Sally Hawkins played the sweet-souled Poppy, who greeted every misfortune with a giggle of unvexed goodwill, and who remains one of the most polarizing protagonists in the Lee canon. Pansy, as clenched and misanthropic as antithesis to Poppy as anyone could imagine, may well join her in that company. In a better world, they'd headline their own buddy comedy. But the brilliance of both characters, and of Hawkins's and Jean-Baptiste's richly inventive performances, is the way they hint at gray zones within their respective emotional extremes. Is a woman's defiant happiness or unhappiness a basic reflex, a learned habit, or a meticulously considered response to the world and its horrors? And that's all we have time for today. By Justin Chang. Justin is the film critic at The New Yorker. He won the 2024 Pulitzer Prize for criticism. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.